It's Wednesday, January 31st, 2007, and you're listening to episode 37 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 7 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and gathered around the warm glow of these mics is Chad.
Howdy.
John.
Hey.
Adam.
Hi.
And Mike.
Hey.
All right, before we dig into all the meaty subjects we have to talk about here tonight, I want to take what you might call a cowardly way out and talk about chicken. So we just had the Worldwide Wing Night.
Oh, I get it. Cowardly.
Okay. Yeah, cowardly, meaty subjects.
That one wasn't
Come
as good.
On,
yeah.
Work with me.
It's utterly terrible.
I know. But let's go ahead and talk about that a little bit. We just had our first international Fear the Boot-sponsored holiday of Worldwide Wing Night, wherein we ask folks all around the world to get together with their friends, and if they're here in St. Louis, to get together with us and enjoy a good bunch of barbecue, buffalo, teriyaki, whatever they prefer, 150 wings.
150 in our case.
And a copious amount of beer.
Yes. I think the parade was my favorite part, but the artillery demonstration came in a close second.
The air show was pretty.
It was good.
You didn't
but it tragically
miss that
ended,
when Buzz Aldrin came over in a B-52.
Oh, did he punch anyone? Because I'd love to see it in real life.
Do you remember the copious amounts of beer?
I do. I remember my Bud Light glass never running out. I didn't buy a single beer, but I bought a bunch of the wings.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I bought 50 wings. We're even.
I'll put it this way, man. After about the third pitcher, Buzz Aldrin was looking a little bit like Russell Crowe.
Oh, man. Well, he is the master and commander of this world and the next.
Yow.
So for those of you that participated, I want to congratulate you because participating in the very first Worldwide Wing Night was about the same as being there for the first Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Just only about, except for the starvation.
And significantly less cholera.
Yeah.
And I don't think we had any Native Americans at ours either, but, you know. I'm like some tiny part Choctaw, so I guess that counts.
Well, yeah. There you go.
Culturally diverse. Excellent.
But yeah, there were people all over the world doing this. In fact, there was one in England that a guy had that actually took place before ours because of the time zone differences and stuff.
Yeah, he sent us some pictures. Actually, we had a couple people, I think. I haven't checked the forums yet today.
There was a couple in Canada.
Yeah, there was a guy in Canada that bought his wings from a place called St. Louis.
St. Louis Wings.
Yeah. So that was crazy.
I didn't realize our city had a wing chain.
I didn't know it did either. I didn't know we had anything.
You know, I can't be too surprised, even though the Buffalo style obviously originated not here. I guess wings in general, sort of a staple food, is a big thing in St. Louis. So I can't be entirely surprised that...
Yeah, we really like our chicken out here.
I think we're going to have to try and have one of these again. Not like tomorrow, but sometime in the not too distant future, probably not wait a whole year. There's two things I want to do differently. One is to actually get a reservation for us.
This would be my suggestion.
One bad thing.
There
about
was a
it.
Little bit of a bottleneck crisis.
Yeah, at the St. Louis one, we had, I guess, about 20 people show up. We had a pretty good turnout. But the problem we had was we showed up.
We had room for 10?
Yeah, exactly. If even 10. I mean, if it was like 8. We show up. And there were tons of parties already reserving all the tables. We managed to get two, push them together. We pick up a third one, tried to bring it over, and got yelled at.
Yeah. And well, we were blocking the waitresses way out of the kitchen.
Well, one of them wasn't. One of them was. One of them wasn't. But
well, eventually we solved that problem by blocking them anyway by the accumulation of two rings of people we had around that one setup.
We just had people sitting there in chairs going out, like you said, two or in a couple spots, like even three deep.
Yeah.
It's like, why don't you just give us a table? So next year we have to make a reservation.
Yeah.
I think I may also see if we can get some of the other gaming podcasters involved in this.
That'd
make
be great.
This more like a gaming podcast holiday, not just a Fear the Boot holiday.
Didn't you say that DLI was out of Springfield, Missouri?
I believe so.
We can get see if we can get those guys to come up for the next one. That'd be cool.
Yeah, or just get everyone in general involved, make this a bigger thing.
No, we could have a party at Lambert's or something.
Well, and every time that we go out and we get something like this going, I mean, a major gaming-related social effort that is all across the gaming podcast.
All across the world.
This helps all of us within the podcast community, both listeners and the creators of these shows, because it just adds strength to the community, and by adding strength to the community, adds legitimacy to that little subculture we have within the gaming culture. So I think that's something we definitely want to look into.
And any holiday that involves hot wings and copious amounts of beer is a holiday I support 100%.
And has a strange historic undertone that deals with role-playing games.
It does. Yes.
Even though it appears nowhere in the holiday, It's like Jesus in a secular Christmas. They're role-playing within the Fear the Boot Worldwide Wing Night.
Excellent.
We have Santa, the pitcher of beer, and Rudolph, the red-sauced wings.
And a role-play game is nowhere. A pear tree.
In fact, I think not one of our guests were non-gamers entirely. Not only non-listeners of the podcast.
I'm trying to think. Is anyone there?
Who's a girlfriend?
I think Einherjar's girl.
I think, because I've talked to her before.
Yeah.
And I asked her, it's like, hey, do you have any dorky pursuits or anything? And she's like, no, not really.
Okay, maybe she was just the one. But out of the way.
She was definitely just along for the ride from the look on her face.
Yeah, and Carla was there, and she's not a big gamer, but she has game before and would again if we ran
Star Trek
a couple types of, very narrow set of games and ran them on a particular schedule to fit around other things in her life. So, yeah, most of our, it was all gamers there, people that at least are interested in role-playing games, even if they don't currently have a group. And we also got to have iTyrant from Forums come out
and explain
the gamer discount.
That man knows how to party.
Yeah, he does. That guy was awesome.
You ever wanted to talk to an eye doctor who would bear all? You got eye tyrant.
Yep.
I learned the tricks they pull on you.
Well, actually, it was great. He was telling us about his gamer discount, where if to prove you're a gamer, you walk through the door with a D20 in your pocket, and when it's all over, he will give you, I think he said, and I'm not like
it's
committing to this,
$10
plus what you roll in that one D20 off your eyeglasses or contacts.
Nice.
So like $30 off of a $100 pair of glasses. That's a significant percentage.
Yeah. I think iTyrant's going to become the official eye doctor of Fear the Boot.
I think so.
I think he is. That's where I'm going for my next contact.
Yep, so am I.
But if you guys are out there and you have some kind of a business, you ought to do stuff like this because every time you do, you just add closeness and legitimacy to the gaming community.
Mm-hmm.
That if you've got a Quiznos, I would love to come in and make a D20 save versus free.
Well, maybe not free.
I would even accept that on a critical failure, I will pay like 50% more on the price. Or like on a D6, I can add in some cookies or something.
Yeah.
You know, maybe this isn't about the gaming community
maybe
so much as
want
I want free stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Poor eye tyrant. He gives us an inch, and then we beat the rest of the community with it.
Speaking of ridiculous ideas that involve the gaming community, let's talk about Wizards of the Coast's current thing.
Oh, God.
And actually, I have mixed feelings
on this. It's Pokemon, the role-playing game.
They have...
That'd be awesome. This is worse.
Okay. Any role-playing game that involves Bill Cosby.
How about Bill Cosby, the role-playing game?
Oh, my God, I get to play Theo.
Generate your Huxtable. Oh, my God, I'm writing up the rules.
Can we get a preview? Any got anything in mind?
Well, it's going to be a level-based system.
It's
going to
be Monistat compliant.
Yeah.
There will be, like, the 80s Cosby Show campaign set, and then there will be the 90s campaign set when it was simply Cosby.
Yeah.
Will there be, like, an adventure module for, like, Leonard Six or...
No, but there will be a Ghost Dad Ravenloft mission in which the mists carry you to 1991.
All right, the Wizards of the Coast thing we're talking about, good old WotC has started up a new effort that they're...
I know about good, but yeah.
They're good like the good bear.
Well, actually, no, they're not even really old.
No, they're
TSR
not.
TSR was old. WotC's actually still relatively new. So, questionable new WotC has started up...
Questionable new WotC.
A new effort called... Expand Your Role. And here's what this is. Let me explain it, and then we are going to dissect it in true Fear the Boot fashion. What this thing basically is Wizards of the Coast has set up a program where they have put aside, they say here $20,000 total, that they are going to pass out in grants to clubs to encourage people to get into role-playing.
At college campuses.
Right. Now, let's take this.
I wonder if it works. Does it work for high schools as well?
I believe this is specifically college campuses.
Because there's a high school... in West County that has a role-playing game club.
Well, it says here the club must be governed by a college or university. So I guess it doesn't even technically have to be a college or university thing, but it has to be some kind of a community thing out of a college. So,
Adam, we could have done this for our gaming group back when we went to college together.
No, yeah, I go to college, and we can't do this for my gaming group, because, Dan, please continue.
Yeah, let's talk about this at the highest level first, before we get into all the details of the program. Now, we have talked about in previous episodes, including, I believe, a bonus on an interview we have not yet released. So, you guys have never heard us talk about, but we have talked about...
We have a backlog of content, and I don't understand why.
Like 2 weeks ago, we were like, we have to record an episode, we have nothing.
Yeah.
Now we have like so many shows that are completely unreleased.
Yeah, but these are all like bonus content.
Crap.
This is not. No, it's all. Some is really good stuff, actually.
Some of it, mind you.
I think the problem is the show really just gets insufficient fiber and liquid.
comes out in long batches.
Once we go, once this show gobbles down like a full head of iceberg lettuce. You're going to log on one more and it's going to be like 8 shows posted all at once.
5 regular episodes, 2 bonuses.
Your iPod's going to be stinky.
Yeah, Song was finished months ago.
Yeah.
We just haven't told anyone.
We've sold thousands of copies.
All right, so on face value, in one of these previous shows we talked about, or previous or future shows, we talked about how role-playing as a whole is kind of stagnating in terms of the market penetration, the number of people that are involved. And we would love to see more people brought in. Now, one of the things that we have seen through this podcast is it seems that it's very, very hard at the high level to get anyone to go out there and do an effective get involved in role-playing games sort of push. And so it really seems that if role-playing games are going to keep growing, it has to be through the grassroots, through podcasts, through outreach, through flyers in your local bookstores, through telling your friends about it. So on the face value, just taking purely what their idea is of, hey, we are going to give you a total of $20,000 in grants, or up to this, over the next year to various university-sponsored clubs that do role-playing game stuff. And you're allowed to use this money towards outreach, I think flyers, building a website, web hosting, whatever you have to do to get the word out, to bring people in. We're going to help foot the bill for this to make it happen. I think that, if we stop right there, is the best thing since 20-sided dice to happen to the gaming community.
Their
I think
heart is in the right place.
I think is a fantastic idea. They are enabling people. They are enabling the foot soldiers of the gaming community to go out there and do the things that currently only privateer press fans are doing. Let's take it now to the next step. Everyone agree with me the basic idea is good. What do you guys think of their concept?
I agree 100% with everything John is about to say.
Good. That's always the most enlightened perspective any of you can ever take.
What's in the fine print? What do they want to have for yeah. these little groups?
Here comes the zinger.
Money?
Exactly. Yeah. Here comes all the zingers. All right.
And you know what? I don't blame them for the zingers.
I don't either, and I'm going to explain it as well.
Because they're giving out free money.
Now,
there's got to
well,
be some sort of controls.
Here's the thing. We, of course, I don't necessarily agree with that, and I'll come back to why in a second, but I'll defend that in a moment. All right, but first, let's go ahead and start kind of working down the fine print. I'm going to start actually in the middle of the fine print. Here's the criteria. And I've got to say that, of course, we are not privy to the discussions behind the scenes. So I'm going to allow right now that there may be these brilliant logical reasons that we do not know for some of this fine print. But I've worked long enough in the corporate world. I can probably guess what they're thinking on a lot of these. And I would wager I'm going to be at least generally right. I'm sure I'm going to miss some specifics or get one or two things wrong. But let's go through these and kind of talk about them. Starting in the dead middle, first of all, this is no surprise, but I don't like it. Dungeons & Dragons must be the primary focus of the club.
Well, it's their company, and they're not...
Exactly.
They are a private company, not a charitable institution, and they are doing this to promote role-playing games in general and their company as a whole.
Okay, let me now hop to why I don't agree with that. And
of course I don't agree with it, because I don't play
well, but
D&D, you know? There's other games out
there. Let's take, for example, like the National Dairy Council.
Mm-hmm.
The simple fact of the matter is that you have game companies right now that are all struggling in one way or another, to one degree or another, from the fact that the RPG market is stagnating. All right. Mm-hmm. So within that context, the more people you get into role-playing games, the more that you do to tear down the negative stereotypes about gamers, the more you do to get your foot soldiers out there spreading the word, the better this is for everyone. And sometimes, perhaps, the best way to go at this is to attack the broader problems that are not necessarily unique to a single company. National Dairy Council. All these people, Peevely and all these different groups, pay money into a single effort mm-hmm. to get more people drinking milk.
That's exactly why this is different. Because you don't have Wizards of the Coast and this company and this company and this company forming a separate council or group that is trying to promote this. You have one company using their money and their resources to do it. I don't disagree with you. You're absolutely right. I think what WotC should do or anybody should do, is try to get all of these other companies together in a bipartisan thing to see how they can do something like this, to see how they can promote it together.
Right.
Instead of this being a Dungeons & Dragons D20 thing.
Let me spin this another direction, explain another reason why I disagree with this that may address the points you're raising a little better. This $20,000 they're setting aside, if I ran Wizards of the Coast, the way that I would view this $20,000 is this is part of an advertising budget. Mm-hmm. This is not some kind of an investment effort, or this is an advertising budget. Now, the next thing you look at, and this is something we talked about, I believe in episode 35 or whenever it was we talked about Ryan Dancy's predictions.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the reasons why people are not getting more into role-playing games. And the reasons, none of the reasons anyone with any amount of sanity would ever come up with is no one's heard of Dungeons & Dragons before.
Right.
The problem is, once again, people don't realize the diversity of games out there. The fact that not all the games are Dungeons & Dragons. People don't realize that these gamer stereotypes are not entirely true. There's more nuance and a good side to this. And these are the kinds of things that if they were broken down, this would only benefit Wizards of the Coast in the long run.
Right.
Even if out of the 20 people it affects, even if 10 of them end up with other game companies, they may still, those 10 may end up back with WotC, and those other 10 may begin with WotC.
But the natural objection WotC has is, I'm the 900-pound gorilla in the arena.
Right.
What the hell do I want to come to the table with and pay my 50%? You know, Steve Jackson's going to jump like a tick on my ass and ride this all the way home.
How are they going to monitor this anyway?
It's going to, I mean, if you're saying like...
That's a question, too.
I mean, if you're saying like, well, here's the problem with coming together in a council. You know, WotC is the big boy in the room, and then you have Steve Jackson come in and Privateer Press and all the guys who are smaller, and even some of the indie guys who are smaller. It's going to be like the European Union in the introduction of the euro. You know, you have all these little countries where their money's not worth anything, and then you have, like, say, Germany, where their money is very, very valuable. Well, all of Germany's wealth is going to bring up these other countries.
Well, I guess what I'm saying, I'll take the reverse thing of what you're saying, Chad. I understand what you're saying. To some degree, I agree with it, even though ultimately the conclusion.
I think that shouldn't matter. I think that these companies need to realize they are all different companies, and I believe in competition.
But they're all riding the same train.
But they're all riding that same boat, and that same boat is slowly running out of gas before it gets to the port. And I think what needs to be done is all these gaming companies need to come together. They need to pool some resources, pool some money, even though there's not much money to pool. I understand that. And they need to be more organized. Instead of just saying, I will give these people grants, they need to put together kits. They need to put together an internet package, like maybe some forum software, some advertising software that's easy to use, that has a couple, you know, WotC has all kinds of stuff like dice generators and character generators and this sort of that. They could package all that sort of stuff in there.
It's free online.
And then they could, yeah, exactly.
You don't even have to know where to look. You go to wizards.com, you can go there in two clicks without knowing
but imagine
a hole in the ground.
Imagine if they put this all together in a package, and then they sent this to you and a little bit of startup money, and even provided free hosting. I have no idea. Make it small to where the bandwidth wouldn't be that bad. And then also provide some print media, flyers and that sort of thing that you can kind of fill out a form, and they'll print up some like 100 flyers for you. And so you can post it all around your campus. I think that would go a lot further than just giving people $50 and having people jump through flaming hoops.
Oh, yeah. Wait to see where the $50 goes before you say they give it to people.
And you know what kind of surprises me about this as well, and this may have something to do with the internal organization of WotC, is the fact that it specifically has to go to D&D, not a Wizards of the Coast product. But specifically, you would not believe the number of people I've been able to get into role-playing, or at least talk about role-playing, when I started somewhere other than D&D, where they said, you know what, I'm not that into the whole Dungeons & Dragons thing, because it's just freaky people killing each other in sewers, but I really like Star Trek.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that, and we can go somewhere else with it.
You know, another thing they need to do, too, is they need to hire some advertising companies. And you know how on YouTube there's like, half a dozen videos about role-playing games that are really funny that promote negative stereotypes in the role-playing community and stuff. Why not produce a funny video, not a commercial, but a funny video like that that's entertaining to watch, makes you laugh, but isn't about negative stereotypes, and then put it on YouTube and try and get it to be popular?
Well, even in the goofy ones where there's the fat beard looking like an idiot, there's usually one reasonably cool guy who's playing the game, making him look like an idiot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. People just don't look at that because he's not the joke.
I'm surprised they don't do something like, you know how Anheuser-Busch will, they'll hire marketing guys.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I met one of those guys in a bar on Wednesday.
They go out to a bar on Friday night, and guy's drinking a Miller, sidles up to him, he's like, hey, can I buy you a Bud Light? And then you look around the bar, and everybody's got a Bud Light that AB is picking up the tab for.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But AB has the wealth to do that.
That's true.
Well, yeah, I know, but you don't have to buy the beer.
But you could do that on a smaller scale, too. I mean,
yeah, hire some college kids to go out to a campus.
Yeah. Why do role-playing game companies send free samples to, not that we've received any free samples, but to people like us, when they should be sending free samples out to normal people?
Well, hang on. Let me correct you on something there. These larger companies, as far as I'm aware, don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was about to say.
That I am not aware of, and I could be wrong, that someone could correct me on this, but as far as I know, even the podcasts that are more into product reviews than we are, I don't think the big companies take us real seriously. That's why I was really surprised when Ryan Dancy responded to us. I didn't think a single damn person out there paid attention to us. And that's part of the problem. I remember when we I was on that thing with the guys from Fistful of Comics.
Mm-hmm. The psychology one?
No, not the psychology one. That was the Geek Label thing.
Oh, yeah, the wild card one.
Yeah, the World of Warcraft card game one. That here we are providing them what was effectively free press to a community that Upper Deck is not used to trying to penetrate. And at no point they said, hey, let me send you guys a media packet. Hey, let me send you guys a free pack of cards or free box of
Here's
cards.
Here's $20 for the starter game.
Right.
Yeah, so, feel free to send us loot cards.
So you guys
no kidding.
So you guys can sit around, play it, and talk about what happened. All right, let's work through some of these other ones before this turns into an episode-long segment. But I guess if it does, I can accept that. This is a good topic. Other requirements is the club must be governed by a college or university.
There's the problem again. The problem is that it's just role-playing games are just like comic books. The people who are playing role-playing games are getting older, and there's no younger people coming into them. You need to start earlier. You need to somehow penetrate the market in high school and junior high.
Hey, high school,
it's
too
tough to get money.
It'd be too hard to govern this.
No, but don't do it like this. You know, giving $50 to, I could see giving $50 to a teacher who wants to start a club in a high school. That's one thing. But also,
herein comes the schizophrenia of the program they're doing right now, because you're about to see exactly that with college kids, which is ridiculous.
So here's the thing. Let's forget about the $50 for a moment. Let's look at marketing. You have to market to a younger generation. You have to get young kids into this.
You've got to spread out in general. I mean, I am the target demographic for a role-playing game. But let's say for a moment that despite all
you're already into it.
Right, but let's say for a moment that despite all my other geeky pursuits, I was not into role-playing games. And I have friends today that I can describe this way, that are into tons of geeky stuff, but have never sat down and tried a role-playing game. These guys are 30-plus years old.
Yeah.
How is this going to reach them? Much less, like you said, how is this going to reach the kids? I mean, they say that most people have pretty much formed their final worldview and set of interests and such by the time they're like 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying people don't grow or change or find new things at all. I mean, as a 30-year-old, I know I've picked up tons of things in my life, like podcasting, since I was 18 years old.
Your hobby is picking up new hobbies.
So, but the point still is that that seems a little narrow. I'm guessing this is reliability and control.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those two reasons alone.
Yeah.
Second one, similarly, the club must have a staff-appointed advisor overseeing the club's activity, such as a school faculty member, librarian,
or
program
director.
Here
is the terrible dinger. We don't go to Bob, the history teacher in college, and ask him if we can use a classroom to play Dungeons & Dragons.
But in high school, they
do. We go to each other's apartments with our own cars and our own books.
Yeah, that's a good point, John. I didn't even think about is the fact that this isn't how role players even operate.
No, it's not.
This isn't how colleges operate.
I mean, now, we did, or I did not, but Chad, I believe you did do a little bit of our role play stuff with a high school teacher.
Mr. Rushing?
Yeah, but
I never played games with him, but we even talked about trying to start a role playing club at Melville, but at that time and in that place, it would not have taken off. But yeah, this was the guy where I told the story where he had his entire class use the Traveler system to make planets and worlds cultures.
And ganked him for his own.
Yeah, and ganked him for his own thing. Yeah.
But yeah, it does exist at high school. In fact, while I was in my high school, there was a magic club established that got rather big. And I mean, this was just a few years ago, well past the games one of the perceived zenith in the late 90s.
One of the Parkway schools has a role-playing game club.
Yeah, we would play against other schools.
Mm-hmm. Webster Groves has a gaming group as well in their high school.
Yeah. That formula where they have, you know, you need the faculty person, yeah, totally understandable why they'd want to do it, does not work for colleges, is perfect for high schools.
Exactly.
But they don't let high schools in on it, and you can only do it in a college.
Yeah, and I recognize that even if we put aside how the money should be spent, that certainly these guys don't want to be handing out money.
Exactly.
Someone's just going to snatch and run.
The question is, how the hell can I get $50 that I can only use to go buy 3.5 books?
I'm going to keep going with this here in a second, but let me just kind of say as a quick side note that is my general theme of responses here. I love what they're trying to do. I think they completely missed the boat on who gamers are and how gaming groups work. This strikes me as like, this was so, and I don't know who came up with this, but this looks like something a board of directors completely detached from the gaming community came up with based on the recommendations of the people beneath them. This
and
is not,
you know,
how
what?
Folks get into gaming.
I hope we're completely wrong, and they are 1,000% successful.
Same here. Yeah,
I don't
if
think
they
that's
bring
happen,
in,
though.
If they triple the size of the role-playing market in the U.S. and we're completely wrong, I will happily eat crow right here on
so
my own show.
Yeah. I would love to see flyers thrown up all around my campus because of this program and this huge official club with all this funding in. But as it is,
for I think
I'm going to remain one of a single-digit number of Dungeons & Dragons DMs on the campus from now until I graduate.
Did we come up with that number on our own, or is that actually on the site that the award is
$50? The goalposts are like 50 and 1,000.
Yeah, they'll
like
actually go higher, but I'll get that in a second.
That's good.
The remaining three things, two are pretty common sense and I have no problem with. One is related to the previous ones. The next one on the list is the club must meet at least once a month. That's fine.
Yeah.
Existing clubs must have at least 4 active members.
That's
fine. Also fine.
Yeah. We know about lone wolfing.
And then the last one is all monies must be paid to the college or university and not to an individual to ensure that the funds are used for the benefit of the club. I understand.
I don't know how that would work. I mean, that does work or wouldn't. I don't know.
Well, I understand what they're saying, that if you pay it to the university for a club, theoretically that they're going to be transparent enough financially.
Yeah.
They'll spend it that
it's
way.
It's a chartered organization. You know what goes in and goes out.
Versus Chad and I, who don't even like role-playing games, we go out and we start our fake club just to build their money and then go.
The Beer and Wing Adventurers.
Yeah. Or John G., who has spent all he's going to ever spend in his life on RPG products, taking his $50 and using it to the beer he drinks while he DMs.
I'm not that worried about it, though. University's not going to be trying to steal your $50. I mean, I think they'd be
honest. Well, I don't think they'd steal it. I just don't think they'd bother to spend it for you.
Yeah, well, the other problem I would say is that this goes back to what we've been saying, that if you're only willing to give it to a university, you have cut off everyone that is outside the age of 18 to 22.
That's true.
Again, I think that this would benefit high schools and junior highs more because I think they're more set up to take in donated money for a club and spend it on the club. I mean, that kind of stuff happens all the time. Bake sales and car washes and that sort of thing.
All right. The next thing they say is that the clubs can apply for a grant amount ranging from $50 to $1,000. Applicants must provide a detailed budget for how this money is going to be spent. I have no problem with that.
Budget your $50. These amounts are kind of on the low end, though. I mean,
up to $1,000. I mean, crap.
Well, yeah.
Well, I'm thinking like.
I mean, you know
50,
what you can do with $1,000?
$1,000.
You can start a successful gaming podcast.
That's right. But $50 it'll buy you 2 source books if you're lucky.
I don't think the money
it'll get you a PhD and 2/3 of a DMG.
Well, it'll give you a good down payment on a TOLUS.
Find a good mortgage at the bank.
You can't use it on TOLUS.
Not a D20 product.
Yeah. It has to be a D&D.
Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, it's a D20
Here's
product.
Here's the thing is, I don't think it's designed so that you can buy gaming books. I think it's more like flyers, renting. There's like a $5 fee.
They list that stuff. Here's what you can use it for.
Oh.
How can the grant be used? You can...
Hookers? Crack.
Strippers? Drugs?
Guns. Illegal guns.
Right. Mercenaries to wield them.
Yes.
There are alternate suggestions. They're kind of plan
Sewers
B.
Sewers with which to run through and kill each other.
Fake elf ears.
Yes.
To wear
Tom Hanks
sewers.
To guest speak.
Guest appearances by Jack Chick.
You can reanimate Strom Thurmond. Have him talk at your event. It's a 3rd-level wizard spell. It requires 2 onyx diamonds of at least 25 GP.
So we're talking maybe in the $500 grant area for
maybe
Strom.
Maybe something like that,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Their plan B outside of undead Strom and all kinds of criminal activity is launch a website, advertise or promote the club locally, rent, expand, or accessorize a space for club gatherings. Send club members to gaming conventions.
Oh, hey.
Provide food for club gatherings.
Oh, there you
okay.
go.
Okay, so I got to spend this on chips and salsa.
How they're requiring you to spend it, I have no problem with.
Yeah.
That's fine. What bugs me is the target they're going after with this.
But how are you going to require that they only play D&D or that they target D&D? You're going to have them tape record all of their meetings and send it into WotC?
That's what the moderator is for.
Yeah.
I guess. And then they're going to have to report back to WotC. We only played D&D this month.
How do I apply? Tell us in 500 words or less how a grant from Dungeons & Dragons will benefit the club. Provide a brief background history on the club and describe how D&D has made a positive impact on your life.
Oh, let's apply. So let's apply to the podcast.
I will apply. I go to college. I don't have a moderator, though. I'm just a gaming group.
So they are going to take money to promote the hobby and promote this and to get new people in it by giving money and promoting people who are already players. Talk about preaching to the choir here.
It is your responsibility.
Yeah, but the choir that goes out and preaches to the illiterate.
John, let me make you this offer. If you can get me on as an adjunct faculty, I will be your moderator.
You could teach undergrad psychology.
I actually have a cousin in the math department.
Well, there you go.
The wheels are turning.
I'd rather get in on it, though.
It is your responsibility.
Well, I'll try.
It is your responsibility to persuade us in your statement of purpose of your passion to achieve your goal and how it will enrich your life. What?
That is so mission statement.
It's for you, D&D.
Seriously, remember, we're talking about Dungeons & Dragons. Let me repeat that. It is your responsibility to persuade us in your statement of purpose of your passion to achieve your goal and how it will enrich your life.
All right, $10 on the table. Person who wrote this blurb has never played a role-playing game.
I called that halfway back up the page. What is this? How it will enrich your life? It's freaking D&D. It's a damned game.
It's fun. I like playing it and talking about it.
If this was like a 12-step program thing or a new cult religion, or
I escaped the world using D&D, and so that I don't have to use weed or alcohol.
It will avert my next murder.
Beer, my anti-drug.
My parents were really abusive.
It will help my criminal defense.
They were scared of me when I started talking about my demon gnome. So they left me alone.
There's actually a guy in my current group that, to this day, hides his D&D files, I think, on his computer from his parents because they think it's totally satanic.
Oh, when I was in high
school. I feel so sorry for the guy.
I had Ravenloft stuff playing out, and my dad would freak.
With a who?
You've gamed with a woman who has to do that.
Your dad freaked out Ravenloft?
Oh, yeah.
Because your parents didn't care about
all the work about Strahd and everything, and all the vampires and everything. My parents decided that I was into something demonic or something like that.
Hmm. Man. See, if there's something kids should have to hide from their parents, it's pornography.
Left the beer out on the counter when I was 18, but I hid the PHB.
Does anyone else have anything to add to this?
Yes.
This is a huge topic, but
it just is so frustrating that people are willing to take effort, like companies are willing to take effort and willing to put money behind it, but I think they're going about it in the wrong way. I think that they're trying to promote people playing role-playing games and bringing new people into role-playing games by funding people who already play role-playing games and don't need the money.
Well, it strikes me this whole thing is like giving water to a starving man. God bless your efforts.
Yeah.
God bless your intentions. God bless the fact that you're putting $20,000 up to get out the word, but the specifics are completely all
exactly.
wrong. I can tell this was a corporate effort.
I think what they're launching on is loan players and DMs using this money in an evangelical effort to get the word out, bring their friends in, get them into the game.
No.
The problem is people with people who are already their friends.
You cannot buy off the evangelical effort. I mean, we talked about before, look at Privateer Press. What has Privateer Press done to get the people out who are like missionaries for their games? They didn't give out $20. They supported their players.
That comes from understanding gamers and gaming, this decision by committee. I mean, like I said, I don't know what came out of this. And for those of you who think that we're just completely jackhammering WotC,
we are. We love their
intentions. We hate their methods.
I mean, if I met the person who came up with this, I would shake their hand before slapping them. It's like you have done a wonderful thing. You have done something bold that I hope breaks down barriers and gets people talking.
If nothing else, they've broken formula. This is brand new.
Yes,
I mean, hats off.
Yeah.
That alone is worth a ton to me, the fact that they were willing to do this. But it's just, I think they're not doing it right. Oh, man, I could go on about this all episode long, but I'd like to get something else in here.
I think we pretty much just have.
Yeah.
No, actually, we got some time. Let's keep talking about some other stuff. Next up on the Hit Parade, and I hope we get to the game design topic today, but you know, if we don't, this was well-spent episode. I don't feel like we screwed anything up here. So,
unless anybody from WotC was listening.
Was like, all right, we're going to give these guys $10,000 as the leads of the program.
They were actually about to make us one of the official Wizard of the Coast podcasts, and now they're tearing up that contract as they listen.
We were gonna have
millions.
I don't have a problem with
that. I say it would have been now or after the first episode we did for them, so we might as well get that done now.
If we were sending them $50,000, they might consider it.
Let's talk about art. We talked a podcast or two ago about art in your new role-playing game. And we said up front that we are not ourselves art professionals or even really artists of any kind.
Doesn't stop us, though.
We are art consumers.
Yeah, I'm not even an art amateur.
And what we got after the episode was done was a couple folks that do work as artists within the RPG community, like professional, real deal kind of stuff, write us kind of a detailed response to the things that we had said. One of those came from Keith Curtis. The other came from a guy who you're actually going to hear more about here in a second by the name of James Stubbs, who is the sales manager for one particular RPG company and is the art director for a smaller independent one. So they kind of wrote us out, look, here's what goes on with art in an RPG. And I want to work through some of the comments they made, because these guys, basically what they told us is you got some things right, you got some things wrong. There's a couple things we just really didn't quite explain it out all the way. So here's the information to fill that in. And since we here are interested in the full story, let's go ahead and work through those. Now, even though Keith and James Stubbs' responses to us were very similar, I'm actually going to use Mr. Stubbs' specific response, because he broke this down in perfect Dan fashion into a numbered list.
I see.
And you just can't beat that crap with a stick.
Imitation's the highest form of it.
Oh, if it had been a Venn diagram with artists on one side and everything we're doing on the other side, it's shown where the two
come together. No intersection.
And then you would have had a phrase like where the rubber meets the road for the intersection.
Where the artist meets the sky's a glass. All right, let's start off with number one on his point. Exposure is a sucker game. Now, one of the things we talked about in the art episode was you could potentially offer an artist that, hey, we don't have any money to offer you, but if you're willing to do this with us and this gets big, then this is going to help get your name out there. The unanimous response from the couple of artists that wrote us back was, this is the wrong way to go. Does not work for artists, even if they think it is going to work for them. That if you want to get someone on board doing art, it is better to either, number one, just tell them up front, I have no money, you're doing this for free. Or secondly, to offer them some small amount of money in return for it, saying, I don't have much money, here's $10 or $20 per picture, than to tell them...
That is a small amount of money
exactly,
for art.
Exactly. But to say that... They said that basically just saying doing something for exposure is the analogy he uses is that that's kind of like asking someone, quote, to paint your house for you on the promise that you'll tell everyone who compliments you on the job about the guy who did it. And you know what? I can't argue with that. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely right. Some of the other options they gave us for paying artists is to don't have reserved rights on it, that maybe you tell them, hey, you can't do anything else with this until after my game's been out for a month or two, but then it's your picture. So if you can resell this to somebody else or sell the original at a con, it's all yours. You can make money that way. To tell them that, hey, we're only going to pay you $10 or $20 up
like
front.
Like they can make prints of it and sell it.
Yeah, or whatever they want to do. It's their picture. Rights revert to them after a very short amount of time. Other options.
Not a good idea with like logos and fonts and stuff.
No, but for like generic art, like pictures, dude with a sword.
The gaming group picture.
Yeah.
They can have that.
All 50 of them.
All theirs. Other things they said is you can do something like work out, hey, we're going to give you $10 or $20 up front for this publishing run, but if we get a second or third run, we'll come back and renegotiate with you based on how the game's doing. He gave a couple options in here. Second point of his, he said that the average print run for a third-tier RPG publisher is...
Now, third-tier is in, like, first-tier is WotC, third-tier is somebody you've never heard of? Or
I guess. He didn't explain this, but that sounds about right. So third-tier, I guess he's talking by small companies. The average print run for a third-tier RPG publisher is 1,000 to 3,000 copies, and the numbers go down from there. A PDF is considered successful if you move 100 to 150 copies.
Ooh.
All right. Now, I don't
know how we say there's no money in role-playing games. there's no money.
Well, keep in mind, this was also third tier. I mean, this is not a first tier game. But let's stop here for a second, and let me say that I'm taking his words at face value. Someone like Daniel Perez, Frazier, who's involved with...
Frazier Rowland?
Yeah, who's involved with Sword's Edge Publishing. They may come along and say, you know what, this guy's smoking crack. It's a whole lot higher, it's a whole lot lower. He's dead on. I have no idea. But the point, nonetheless, that he's making is completely valid. And given the fact that he's involved in a smaller company, I'm going to assume he does know what he's talking about. But the point he's making is completely valid, which is, like Chad was saying, your chance of making a ton of money in the role-playing industry is pretty freaking slim. I wouldn't say it's zero, because there are people out there that make a full-time living in the RPG industry.
Well, hell, we're already millionaires off of it.
Yeah.
John's lighting a Swisher Sweets off of $100 bills.
Dude, hold up. I got to put it out. I have to talk again.
But if you're dropping out of college to get into RPGs,
get back into college.
Yeah, now's when you go crawling back to the dean. Third, he said, occasionally you'll see someone offer profit sharing. This likewise is a joke unless said person is an established publisher. This is asking the artist to take the same risk as the publisher that a product will either never come out or underperform. So once again, what he's saying here is don't offer something like, hey, we'll give you 5% of what we sell. Because
you're not going to sell anything.
What if? Yeah, you may never sell anything, or similarly, you may just drop the ball and never even put it out at all.
Not finished production.
Fourth, this is what I said before. I said offer to pay something. But if you can at least offer some kind of money, at least the point is, even if it's not fair pay, it keeps you from looking like a scammer.
Yeah.
That if you say, I'm going to give you $20 for this picture because I'm broke, at least you don't look like the guy just nudging and winking and promising the sun, moon, and stars that, hey, I'm going to pay you nothing, but when my RPG is on the shelf of every person in the U.S., you're going to be so famous and so rich. And fifth, he said, and I actually mentioned this before too, offset your lack of cash by offering other incentives, like negotiating lower rates but being less restrictive on the rights. We already talked about that. Sixth, this is one that I think is not an art thing. This is with every business endeavor in your life. Pay on delivery.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
I've even seen this as a writer, where I have written stuff, and of course you're told the check's in the mail. And it is months later before I see that money, if ever at all. And you know what? This artist took real time to make this picture. And this artist, therefore, if you've told him he's going to get money, should get real money for it that can be used to pay for whatever he or she wants within his or her life. It's written here in response to art. But I told this guy when I responded to him, I said on number six, I would never do otherwise. To me, this is a point of personal ethic and morality. If somebody hands me something and the payment is due, they will get the money right there. And if I don't have the money, then I'll tell them, look, hold the product or something.
Mm-hmm.
If someone hands you something, you're just telling the checks in the mail, that's no more fair to them than it would be for your employer this week to tell you, you know what, I realize payday's Friday. We're kind of working some stuff out. You know, the wife wanted me to change the way I'm spending corporate profits, so it may be next month before I can send this out. So thank you, James, for sending that in. Thank you as well, Keith Curtis, for your lengthy reply and feedback on our show.
Mm-hmm.
If any of you guys, upon hearing stuff we say, are, you know, really know this stuff inside and out and feel that we missed some points or misspoke, let us know. You know, feartheboot.com. And even if you're not a professional anything, please stop by feartheboot.com and just drop us an email or hop on the forums and just interact with the community in general. Got a great bunch of people out there, and we'd love to hear from you. All right, I think we can still tackle today's gaming design topic. We are probably not going to reach the Skies of Glass Q&A, but that's okay. All right, this episode we've had a lot more banter-ish topics than we normally do, but we still have enough time left to do our design advice. So we'll have to kind of squeeze it in, but it's okay. This one's not one of the thicker subjects we've talked about. Probably going to have to drop the Skies of Glass Q&A in the interest of keeping this close to an hour, but that's all right. We can pick that up next time. The issue we're going to talk today, now that we are in the rules spread of the series, we are going to talk about writing rules or balancing the rules for rolling dice versus role-playing, specifically in regard to social interaction. All right, what do I mean? We've talked about on this podcast before where you can have it where a character encounters an NPC and the characters try and convince the NPC guard that, no, I'm not actually stealing this. You need to let me go. And at this point, the question is, do you roll dice? Is it my diplomacy versus his intelligence or whatever the game may call for? Or do we just role play it out and see how the GM feels about it.
Straight role-playing.
So.
Here's a problem with straight role-playing.
No, there is no problem.
There is
a problem. Go ahead
and
say
there's no balance, because if your character has his strengths that are on the paper and your strengths as a player, your character has more strengths than he should. For sake of balance, your character has the weaknesses that are on the paper and the strengths that are on the paper. And if diplomacy is not one of his strengths, then diplomacy should not be one of his strengths.
So what you're saying is that you're playing the unintelligent barbarian who kind of talks.
Is that what you wrote? Is that the character you made?
Yes.
Then yes.
And then you need to do this diplomacy thing, but you are a really excellent speaker. You're well spoken. You're well educated. You're very clear in your speaking, and you can role play out talking this guy around in circles.
But your character cannot.
So you need to roll that. No, you need to role play in character.
But if I can role play better than my character can, the die roll
is
irrelevant.
Let's put the shoe on the other foot. What if I, John G, the weakling, need to have my character lift a 500-pound boulder to let people out? I mean, here's a weight. Try it.
Unless you're LARPing, you really can't act that out.
Yeah. Well, let me pull this back a little bit. We're talking about game design, and you guys are arguing playstyle preference.
But, you know, that's important, and here's why
this will manifest in the game.
Here's why it's important. Because, and this is what I want to drive home, is what you are making here is a decision about how your game is meant to be played.
Exactly. Now, here, let me reference what I was saying. Do I think that you should roll the dice or role play it out? My view is you should role play it out when I'm running a game. Do I think that a game, and every single game ever made, should have a mechanic in it to allow you to roll the dice? Yes, it should. Because a game master can choose to throw that out or use it or not use it. And that way the game is scalable. Every game I've ever ran has like some sort of social role, social feature, social mechanic that I consider this is an aspect of role playing. And I never use it. But I'm glad it's there.
And it does allow the role player to play something that isn't he himself. For example, let's say English is your second language and you're playing a game here in the United States. And you have to play a very well-spoken, extremely suave courtier. It's inordinately difficult, and you have to have a mechanic to do that in the same way that I would need a mechanic to lift a boulder.
The question that you're really asking, and this in many ways should fit into the broader context of how you're trying to engineer the game as a whole, is at this stage, you've got these little scales, and on one side of the scale, one little pan, you've got simulation, and on the other side of the pan, you've got pure, soft role-playing. And the fact is, anything you put on one side of the pan, you take off the other. If you go Chad's route and you take the strict role-playing side, then you have to accept that what you're allowing to happen is someone may role-play out something that is either worse or better than their character, if real, would have done in that exact same situation.
But on the flip side... The check and balance for that is IC role-playing, which you can't write into a mechanic from a game design perspective.
And I absolutely agree with you, Chad, that you should trust the players to do this, unless you've got one duck in your group that you know you got
to
look at.
Right, now, but of course, part of this, keep in mind, you might be able to role play down ICLE, and I've seen people do it.
Yeah. This is one of the points. Yeah.
Where someone says, I'm supposed to be stupid, so I'll be stupid. But I've also seen people that in the interest of wanting to win whatever's going on, even though they're dumb, oafish barbarian, they come up with something that even though it's put in dumb, oafish speech, it's arguable, and it's meant to be arguable, but there's kind of like, I don't know that I could 100% see that, but there's enough debate in there that they're screwing the game.
That happens a lot.
It happens a whole lot.
And I think that reaches back to one of the other episodes where we had where, and I don't want to bash character advancement or character rewards too much, but I think that when you start having really big rewards and heavy character advancement, the game becomes a competition, so you try to get the advantage for your character. And to me, a role-playing should not be about playing out the advantages of a character. Right. It should be about playing out, A, the advantages, B, the disadvantages, and C, the things that are normal for your character.
Let me make the flip side point now about role-playing up, which is simple matter of fact. There's no human being in the world that's capable of role-playing up. No one can be more intelligent than they really are. Now, once again, I'm not saying, just like Chad's not, that there's one way that's right or wrong. But what I am saying is you now, as a game designer, are making a choice. If you put pen to paper and you start writing the rules on here's oration and here's diplomacy and here's con and here's intimidate and here's how the rules are made and here's how the rules are saved against, you have sent, subconsciously at least, the message that these rules are intended to be used. You have now set some kind of paradigm about how this game is played. If you're trying to make something that's very, very loose, an amber diceless or a live-action role-playing game or something like that, you've probably just created a level simulation that was not right for your game. Similarly, if you're creating a game that just, this doesn't even fit the feel, this is a comedy game, or this is meant to be a game about people with really unusual personalities,
or this game is intended to be a LARP where it is super rules light because you don't have dice and you're not sitting around a table, you're in costume running through the woods, then, yeah, you it's all about the role-playing then.
No, I'm in the sewer running around with my gat. I'm going to run you down.
That's right.
I do not want to play in that game.
Dude, it's got drugs. It's awesome.
And Tom Hanks.
Something that I so far have only seen in a very small number of games that I like, I don't know if we'll put it in Skies of Glass or not, maybe we will, is quick NPC rules, where you can take a handful of charts. Let's say they walk into the inn. You wrote no character for this innkeeper. And you didn't mean for them ever to role play with this guy. You didn't even mean for them to go into the inn. And maybe sitting there, you're just not that creative on the fly, or maybe you are, but you're just having a bad day. You can flip to a page, shoot some dice, pick a few easily role played quirks for him, maybe even roll kind of initial reaction that this guy, positive, negative, somewhere along a continuum. And within about two or three die rolls, you can immediately have a character on the spot that, aha, this innkeep has a twitchy left eye. He speaks louder than he should. And
he actually
has a huge beard. And he takes a positive view of the characters when they walk in. And you can make up on the spot.
So this is like my curious and incontinent toad.
Yes, like your curious and incontinent toad I rolled up for you.
Very good.
I like that kind of stuff. I wish more games had it. I don't think it should be a required rule, but it's a great resource for that sort of metagame problem of on-the-fly NPC generation.
I agree. I love on-the-fly NPCs. They save me work. And they provide me with challenges.
It also, I think, pushes game masters outside of their
absolutely
other ruts.
Yeah.
Because you create something, like the incontinent toad John is talking about, is whenever someone takes the familiar, to give it some kind of color, I open up the Dungeon Master's Guide for 3rd edition, and somewhere in there is a quirk chart that I've mentioned before.
Yeah, it's in the NPC section or something like that.
I roll against it twice, and for John's familiar, I rolled up curious and incontinent. So here was going to be a toad that was forever trying to dig into his backpack. As soon as
and
John found him, he
things.
Gets scared and pee everywhere. And I would never have come up with that on my own. That's just not the way my brain
no
works.
No sane person should come up with that on their own.
You know, one of the flip sides, I guess, to the kind of the rules versus role play thing, and this is an extreme where I would start to take Chad's side of the debate.
Woohoo!
Is it time?
Somebody's got to.
That you can reach game breaking rewards. You have social rules that usurp the plot, I guess. That here's the Baron that should hate all the characters, yet you have a really high oration skill and a really high charisma, and you shoot the dice. And according to the rules, he's got a pre-prescribed, I don't know, response rating or whatever it's called in your game, reaction rating, and you rolled this, and he's got a that.
And now you're exalted.
And now you're exalted. Or you walk into the town, and even though you're not meant to have it, it makes no sense, because of the fact that you're such a level and have such a feat, you now have an army of henchmen.
Or perhaps, well, the half-orcs get a -5 in this town, and you rolled a 1. The mob is on you.
And we can cut the middle of the road here, because Chad has a point that, I mean, role-playing is good, and we don't see very much of it in our games, or at least not enough. So maybe we can cut the difference by saying, if you know, let's role-play it out, let's see how it goes, but let's also roll the dice. If you impress the Game Master with your role-playing, maybe you get a bonus to your dice roll, rather than having it be all dice or all role-play, some kind of hybrid.
Yeah, and personally, that's what I typically try to do, is I'll have somebody role-play it out, because I don't want role-playing to disappear from the game.
So,
but what I may say is, okay, you said this, and here's how convincing it is. Let's shoot some dice, and I'll kind of color my view of it that way. That
yeah.
This is
I actually like that idea a lot.
Well, let me ask you this. Would you suggest to somebody who's making a role-playing game, they come to you and they ask you this question of how I should do this with the social interaction, would you suggest to them doing a system that in the mechanic in and of itself decides nothing. You roll your diplomacy. It doesn't give you a pass fail. It merely gives you something that kind of colors the RP. Like, generally favors it.
I would back up a
question.
Or
the role playing itself. Good role playing that's IC gives a bonus to the role.
I would back up from that. I would say, look, as you design this game, you, of course, have this field document we're always referring to. This game is meant to feel like something. But then on top of that, when we get down to the nitty-gritty of the rules, you have an opportunity to, in some way, affect what is going around the table of some number of gamers out there in Gamerland. And what I would say to him, what is the experience you're trying to create? That when these group of couple people get together and somebody's trying to slip out of the dungeon, is trying to convince the guard that, no, I'm actually one of you guys and I just need to get out of here to go get my lunch. What do you want to transpire?
Mm-hmm.
If the real player cannot talk to save his life, what do you want to happen? And based on that, that's where you've got to make some decision. I like the idea you're getting at of using the dice, not necessarily to do pass-fail. You're not saving versus diplomacy so much as, okay, because of the way the diplomacy rolls, I'm going to kind of take that into account.
Mm-hmm.
That I think Mike, for example, was...
Like if you totally pooch your diplomacy roll, the guards don't instantly arrest you. You have to role play, and now their disposition
right.
towards you is you're going to have to jump through a little bit more.
Or something like, you know, Mike was extremely unconvincing. He walks up and says something to the guards that in this land would get you killed, but he makes like a critical success on his mm-hmm. diplomacy role. I may have the guard say, wait, I'm sorry, I got distracted. What did you just say?
Yeah.
I didn't catch the last part
of that.
Maybe
you got the one culturally understanding guard in the entire kingdom, or we'll walk you through.
Or he thinks you're joking or whatever. It's like, from the Western Kingdom?
And then you're just kind of like,
that's funny.
Yeah.
And
Soviet Russia's sword rolls you.
On the flip side, you get the guy whose wife has been bitching at him all morning, and no matter what you say, he's just in the mood to bust balls.
Mm-hmm. He'll blow you off at best, and it goes downhill from there.
Yeah.
Something else kind of along these lines you got to ask yourself about is, do you want any kind of NPC reactions that are decided entirely outside of the game? For example, within Shadowrun, I think D&D does this as well, you have the ability that if you create your character right, you can actually begin the game with one or more people already in your pocket. That you have NPCs who may have, I mean, what may be significant power.
Yeah, you have contacts.
Yeah, they have that in Star Wars, too. When you play a noble class, you have so many people who owe you a big favor.
Oh, and Shadowrun goes beyond contacts. You can get actually, like, best friends.
Gangs?
Yeah, you can get whole gangs, tribes that are not just at your beck and call, but...
This sounds stupid.
Tribes of magic trolls.
But...
emo trolls.
You gotta ask yourself, do you want this? Because on the one hand, it can allow groups to kind of round themselves out a little bit by taking along bodyguards or, I hate to say, even cannon fodder.
Do you want Nodwick? Do you want the henchman? Who are you going to load 600 pounds of chests on so you don't have to get encumbered?
Yeah, be careful. You're encouraging our listeners to use their gangs as cannon fodder.
Well,
here.
No, everyone's read Nodwick.
Well, I wouldn't say, really more what I was getting is, let's say you're playing, let's keep going to Shadowrun, you're playing a game where you're a corporate man, and for the game you're really going to need a hacker. You could create a retainer who has all these hacking skills to help you succeed
so
in the game.
So should you make a game mechanic that allows for that?
Yeah, should you allow that?
I think that it depends on your feel. I mean, if you're talking about a game like, we'll say Shadowrun, we gave a whole bunch of examples about how that could be a bad thing. And I'm sure you can come up with examples how that would be a good thing. But a game John and I were talking about earlier, Birthright, where you play a noble and you're working your way up through the aristocracy. Oh, it's totally understandable that you'd have a squadron
of
knights and retainers.
In fact, you have to have hundreds of them because you're a lord.
It really depends on the feel and what you want out of it. And also, it goes beyond feel, too. As a game designer, you have to look at, okay, how is my game set up? And is this going to be something that is going to annoy and piss off the GM? Okay, I allow as a standard thing in Shadowrun. Say I'm making Shadowrun. I allow a standard thing. To where it's very easy, you can get a feat or an extra advantage or whatever. You can spend some points. You can get a gang, a motorcycle gang that is a cell phone call away. Oh, as a game master, that is 3.5 aspirin right there, just for that.
And that's one thing you always have to bear in mind is that.
But in Birthright, that's a really cool thing.
And of course, in any game, you may put rules in there that are intended for a certain situation. But if these rules aren't very carefully crafted, a rule that is meant for the right situation can also be used for the wrong one. That in Shadowrun, just as that retainer may be a great idea, if I've only got two players and they need that hacker to round out the group, I've also got to keep in mind that I could have six guys and every asshole at the table shows up with a retainer or a gang.
And leadership in D&D.
And I would agree that we should try to use each other as player characters to fill these roles and compensate for what we can't do. I mean, that's what a party's for. The game is not one dude with his five henchmen. The game is six PCs.
A lot of this, too, do you even really need a mechanic for it? Your party needs a medic or a hacker or a whatever. The game master can just give you one. Do you really have to write in a mechanic for it? It, like in Adam's game, for instance, that we're playing now, my guy is second in command of a thief's guild. We didn't roll up a thieves guild. I didn't take an advantage of a thieves guild. He knows I'm not going to abuse a thieves guild.
Let's take an example from Skies of Glass.
But it's there anyway.
One of the play styles we talked about in Skies of Glass that we would like to allow is these kind of secondary career things. So let's say maybe that I'm the operator of a merchant caravan, and we have the rules in here for dry good trading from one town to the next. Now, part of the problem is, as part of the budget, I may have to contract a certain number of mercenaries or thugs that I have to budget into my already tight budget to protect this caravan. That's intended.
Yeah.
Now, different gaming group, it's four guys that just kind of wander around doing nothing. They happen to break into a bank vault and get a crap ton of gold, and now all of a sudden they're using those rules. Well, technically, according to these rules, I can actually afford 15,000 mercenaries for the next month.
I don't know what you're talking about.
So I'm going to use those 15,000 mercenaries to take over the southeast of the United States.
I have an
There was a bank vault involved, but I
And there was
remember.
A substantial amount of gold, and there were people hired.
You know, I'm going to take these 15,000 mercenaries now and go take over the southeastern part of the U.S. And, of course, at this point, someone would say, wait a minute, as a game master, that's fine. They wake up one morning and somebody stole all the gold, or the mercenaries turn on them.
10 minutes later, the merc captain has decided that's a great idea, and he's going to do it with his own men.
But the point is, the
game... It's a dicey situation.
The game creator has to understand, to some extent, they created that problem. Now, conversely, maybe there's good reason for that. If we're doing the merchant caravan thing, I may have no choice but to tell you what a mercenary costs. And I can't stop anyone from abusing that, but you have to accept you put it in there, it will be abused.
Yeah. So, in the end, should you make that kind of mechanic in your game? I think that, generally speaking, you should. I just think that the level of detail and how powerful the rules allow and what the rules allow depends on your feel. If you've got a game like, you know, I don't know, your standard D&D game or whatever, Shadowrun like we're talking, allow the ability to get gangs and hirelings and stuff, make it kind of minimal. Whereas if you're talking about a game like Birthright, or say you're doing a special forces game where you can call in airstrikes and stuff like that, make it more so.
Yeah, I'd agree with Chad. Put it in there, but
look at your feel.
Use it unless it really needs to be used.
I think if you're designing it, you cannot stop designing something because someone is going to take advantage of it.
Exactly.
Because no matter how much thought we put into it, no matter how much we think about how to screw our own system, Phil will sit down at the table and screw us out of our own system.
You know, I
guaranteed.
I fall somewhere I generally agree with, but I guess it's kind of a tight spot because on the one hand, while you cannot write the rules with the cheater or the abuser in mind, because you're going to write 20 times the rules you need to, complicating the game for the honest people, you have to take them in account enough that you're not leaving them obvious doors and windows by which to wreck an otherwise balanced game. So like in the case of hiring henchmen, should you disallow it or not provide rules for it simply to stop the conquest of the U.S. abuse? Probably not. But at the same time, should you allow a character trait where you can roll into the game with 1d6 mercenaries, and you can take that as many times as you like? Heck no. Because you're just handing the one jerk at every gaming table the keys to your game.
All of my stats are at the minimum.
Yeah.
And I have 2,000 henchmen.
And
I only need to be strong enough to point.
No, there's plenty of other ways to abuse the system, like buying chickens and sending them out in the dungeon.
That's never happened before.
No, never once.
That's right. Dungeon traps are pressure sensitive. Chickens are one copper piece of each.
There you go. There's always ways
hilarity ensues.
Yeah. And then you can
coffers
eat them
and chickens. My new spinoff game.
Whenever we talk about rules and stuff like for Skies of Glass outside of the podcast, I always try and keep my mind on, is this tools that a game master can use? I try not to think of it as abuse or not abuse. It's like when we're designing rules, how can this help a game master?
That's a really good perspective in mind, that don't think of it as so many leashes as much as take from the positive angle of how can the game master, I'd add players, is this something they can use to improve the enjoyment of the game or maybe to stop obvious abuses versus are these rules I have in there just for the sake of being leashes on people?
Yeah. Or just for the sake of we need some numbers and we need to crunch them.
Right.
And when you come to rules that aren't necessarily things that need to be defined, I would define them in a game creation thing anyway, because what if the GM doesn't think about it? You know, what if it's a new DM and they've never played a game before or never run a game before and they need some more information or some more, hey, I didn't think about, you know, followers or whatever.
Right.
And that people who are more seasoned can skip over it, make it an optional rule.
Exactly. And, you know, what if as game designers, we'll take the example of having henchmen and a mechanic for getting henchmen. What if you don't do that in your games and the other game designers don't do it in their games? You just don't put it in, but everybody else does that. You know, you got to think beyond of what, when you design a game, you have to think beyond just your style of gaming.
Yeah. Right. Most people are going to come into your game with the mentality they've picked up from countless other games they've played. Yeah.
Now, this doesn't mean that you don't have that completely flavor and color your game. I mean, there's a reason why this isn't a D20 system and such, but
you got to have a 2-hit roll somewhere.
Somewhere. You can't avoid somehow.
It. Yeah.
Well, here on the cusp of what may be the longest episode Fear the Boot has ever done, I think we are going to bring this one home. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot. This show is copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in the show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to FearTheBoot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at FearTheBoot.com.